From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the program, as Harley prepares to celebrate its 110th anniversary, it works to appeal to a broader audience. Then the Optimus Theater opens As You Like It in their new home in Caddish Park.
It's going to be a production where one of the unique things about it is the audience is going to see a lot of the nuts and bolts, the behind-the-scenes kind of things that happen.
A new documentary focuses on the world and the appeal of early American circuses.
Back then, they didn't have the internet. They didn't really have much photography. And so the first chance people ever got to see a lion or an elephant or any of these exotic performers was actually in the circus.
And Milwaukee writer Dean Jensen's new book spotlights the rise and fall of two circus superstars. Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. Welcome to Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us today. Tens of thousands of motorcyclists are expected in Milwaukee late next month to mark the 110th anniversary of Harley-Davidson. The last big celebration of the iconic Milwaukee manufacturer was 5 years ago, and organizers are optimistic that the celebration will be even bigger and louder this time out. They're also optimistic about the future of the company, which may not have been the case in 2008. Reporter Rich Revito writes about the evolving fortunes of Harley-Davidson in the July issue of Milwaukee Magazine. He talked with Mitch Tyke and said Harley has been in a financial predicament that could be described as tenuous.
Well, tenuous by Harley standards. They had been on this roll for 20 years or so where there were increased shipments of motorcycles, increased revenue. Profits were always really, really strong. You'd go to the annual shareholders meeting and it would be this big love fest because the shareholders were happy. The consumers were happy for the most part. But when the 105th anniversary rolled around in 2008, behind the scenes as this big party was going on, there was some consternation among Harley execs about where the economy was headed and what impact that was going to have on consumer spending, i.e., would people have enough money to continue to buy luxury items like Harley-Davidson motorcycles? And it turned out that they didn't. And consumers tightened their wallets and Harley sales plummeted, profits fell. And for the first time in a long time, Harley was dealing with an issue. I don't want to go as far as to say it was financial survival, but they certainly shifted into a mode that they hadn't been in for a very long time.
And at the same time, there were labor issues as well.
That was all part of it. Yeah, the big assembly plant out in New York, Pennsylvania, they went on strike out there, led to a delay in production at the other plants as well here in the Milwaukee area too, which led to some temporary layoffs and later some permanent layoffs with all the restructuring that went on. But when the 105th rolled around, it wasn't beneath the surface. It was not a very happy time at Harley-Davidson.
But of course, at the same time, there were a lot of happy Harley owners here, a lot of Bruce Springsteen fans, as I recall. Mm-hmm. And in the middle of all this, there then came a big change in leadership, which I seem to remember the two of us talked about in this studio or a similar studio as it was happening. What was the big deal about that change?
The big deal was they went out and got a leader from another company. Harley had had this history of, especially since the management buyout in the early 1980s, of just promoting from within. And things had gone so well for Harley in the years following the management buyout that nobody really seemed to raise an eyebrow about that. 4 years ago, they went out and got Keith Wandell, who was the number two guy at Johnson Controls. I don't think anybody's going to confuse Johnson Controls and Harley-Davidson. So
they don't wear a lot of ties at Harley.
No, they don't. They wear a lot of suits and ties at Johnson Controls. So here was this 21-year veteran of Johnson Controls being asked to shift gears, so to speak, and come over to Harley-Davidson, a complete outsider being asked to make some very, very dramatic and difficult and necessary changes at Harley-Davidson.
Do you think Harley thought that it would take an outsider to make those big changes?
I'm assuming that they were astute enough to know that. It seems to be the general consensus that they had to go outside to get somebody to make these changes. He didn't have any loyalties within the company, this being Keith Wandell. And Keith has told me in a number of interviews over the years and definitely for this story as well that he doesn't think he would have gotten done what he needed to get done had he come up through the ranks. He didn't have those loyalties. He may now after 4 years, but he didn't have them then.
You recount a fateful meeting he had with employees fairly early in his tenure.
That was actually at a shareholders meeting 3 years ago when an employee, a longtime employee of a Milwaukee area Harley factory, had gotten up and asked about what he was going to do to preserve jobs, and he basically gave no guarantee whatsoever. He said that there were some hard decisions coming up and that ideally everyone could hold hands and walk into the sunset, but that wasn't the way it was going to be. If you looked at where the economy was headed a few years back, he did not make any promises about jobs, and Harley ended up slashing several hundred jobs over the ensuing years.
Talk a little bit more about that restructuring. They slashed a few hundred jobs. What else did Harley do to set about digging itself out of this hole it found itself in?
Well, a lot of it came down to improving their production processes, too. When things were going full bore, they had a lot of employees. They realized that they needed to tighten up the way they manufactured products. Before Wandell got there, I think from concept to implementation was sometimes as long as 5 years on these new bikes. After this restructuring, it's down to three and a half years. They negotiated with their unions to use seasonal workers, which raised the ire of the longtime rank and file that didn't want the seasonal workers coming in. But they wanted to better match peak production periods with their ability to get out bikes. And now they claim that they can get bikes to dealers faster, and the bikes that the dealers want and the consumers want, there's a better match there now than there was before.
Are trends in motorcycle buying more seasonal than they are in car buying?
I would think so. I mean, if you look at what happened last year, Harley had an incredible early part of the year last year because we had this unseasonably warm weather that started even around here, started in March of last year. They ran into a little bit of problems in the first quarter of this year because of the extended winter and the early rainy season leading into the spring and early summer. So sales were down a little bit because of that. But it's definitely seasonal, and they've gotten into this usage of seasonal workers now, and it seems to be working at this point.
Well, one of the issues that you write about is that Harley seems to be dealing with this question of whether their target demographic is aging or aging out of, of motorcycles, if you will. And within the company, they seem to have two answers to that question. No, it's not aging. But if it is, they're also going after other demographics. And it seems like there are risks and rewards to both of those answers.
This has been a long time question for Harley-Davidson. Their main base consumer is a middle-aged, well, sometimes beyond middle age, white male baby boomer, basically, that had the financial wherewithal to buy an expensive Harley-Davidson motorcycle. There are some analysts and industry followers that said that if Harley had actually broadened its base prior to the recession, that they wouldn't have been hit by the recession as hard as they were. So a few years back, they started making this change where they changed a lot of their marketing programs and went after more women, more minority riders. Another key demographic was going after younger riders, which Harley didn't seem to have an in with. They had the Buell line of bikes, but that was so radically different from the regular Harley-Davidson motorcycles, and Wandell ended up getting rid of Buell anyway. So they just started marketing different styles of bikes, all black bikes, so you didn't have the big giant chrome cruiser that maybe your dad or your grandfather was riding. They started hosting these parties that were just designed for women where they could come in and comfortably experiment with getting on a bike.
And this makes this is the Tupperwareization of a Harley-Davidson.
Exactly. And you run the risk of whether or not this is going to alienate that core consumer base. I talked to a few folks. They don't seem to care all that much about it. They want the company to survive and thrive, and if that's what they have to do. Talked to a few other experts who said that this is a brand that's so drenched in testosterone and outlaw testosterone that that they think there will be some alienation along the way. But this is a company looking to broaden its base, and they think they can do that without alienating the longtime base consumer.
Well, and you're right. At least one of the Harley executives says what you would expect. The way some analysts talk, it's as though there were no Caucasians born since 1980.
Yes. And that's the thing. You get that, you know, the baby boomers are aging out now, but you're having the Gen Xers that are moving into that. And as they age, you would assume are further along in their careers and have maybe more discretionary income to spend on this. So there's definitely going to be a shift that way. But they have definitely been very aggressive in going after more women, more minorities, and younger riders with their marketing programs and the styles of bikes that they're coming out with.
So if Harley-Davidson was troubled beneath the surface 5 years ago, how would you describe the state of things at Harley today as the company prepares to celebrate 110 years?
I was going to say cautiously optimistic, but I think it goes beyond cautious. I think there's definitely a feeling that even though the economy is still on shaky grounds now, it's not nearly as horrible as it was 5 years ago. I talked to several dealers. They seem to back everything that Wandell and his team have done. I think it's definitely going to be more of a celebratory mood throughout, not just with the consumers, but with Harley management, the dealers. There seems to be a little bit of a love fest going on right now, for lack of a better word.
But, and the dealers are independent business people, right?
Correct. And 5 years ago, they had a lot of issues with where Harley was headed. They thought that they were getting the wrong kind of bikes. They thought sales were way down. Over 100 dealerships closed during the recession. But for the most part, everybody seems to be happy about where things are going now and happy about the quality of bikes that are coming out. I think a lot of the fears that were around 5 years ago have been alleviated.
So what do we know about the future? For example, how long Keith Wandell is likely to stick around, and whether there is a succession plan or the company is likely to go outside again?
Mm-hmm. I asked him that question point blank, and he kind of – I won't say that he danced around it. He gave me an answer and just said that he has no immediate plans to leave. Everybody was saying that they were sure he was going to stay through the 110th, that he wasn't going to leave before this milestone anniversary. But he's in his mid-60s, early to mid-60s. He's not going to stick around forever. He's accomplished most of what he set out to do when he got here. And the dealers told me that if he leaves now or sometime in the near future, they're okay with that because they think that he's developed a management team there that buys into to his organizational plan, and that even if he's not the top dog there, that they'll still be able to move forward positively there. He doesn't seem like he's going to leave anytime in the near future, but he did say that there's succession planning going on, not only at the CEO level, but other levels of management as well. It seems like it's thought out and they're looking to the next step, and whether or not that comes from inside or outside, I think they could probably go back inside again for this one. There's talk that Matt Levitich, the number two guy at Harley right now, would move into that slot. Whether or not that happens, I guess, remains to be seen. But I'm not sure they'd be as dramatic this time around in picking a leader.
At least he didn't leave before the magazine came out.
Correct. That's always a fear.
Well, and along the future lines, you write some about the Harley efforts in other markets, places like China and India. Where does that effort stand?
You know, that Harley has wanted to go into those markets for a long time because you've got those such huge consumer bases there. You got folks in those countries that have more discretionary income now. But it hasn't been all roses in those markets either. I was in China 5 years ago when they were opening dealerships over there. Sales were very, very minimal. There's a lot of governmental regulations over there, as you can imagine, where they don't want big motorcycles driven in the inner rings of cities like Beijing and Shanghai. They're used to having motorcycles as for utilitarian purposes. The consumers over there, leisure riding is a foreign concept to them. Seems like they've had more traction in India, and they're actually assembling bikes in India with kits of parts made in the United States. They're assembling them over there to avoid a lot of the tariff issues. But those could be down there. I think they're looking at both of those markets as long-term markets. But it's not just those two countries. They've entered Turkey and some other places over the years as part of an aggressive expansion plan to get into as many countries as they possibly can.
Rich Rubito, thanks.
Thank you, Mitch.
Rich Rovito's article about Harley-Davidson, called Iron Strong, is in the July issue of Milwaukee Magazine. He spoke with Mitch Tyke. There is a link to the article from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. It's summer and time for Shakespeare in the Park. The Optimist Theater has a new production and a new home. We'll learn more when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. For the past three summers, Optimist Theater has presented Shakespeare in the Park for Milwaukee audiences. Starting with The Tempest in 2010, the company has also produced Twelfth Night and Macbeth. For these past 3 years, the company has performed at Alverno College, but this summer finds them performing in a new space, the amphitheater in Cottage Park. On the bill this year is As You Like It, the story of banishment and forgiveness, mistaken identity, and true love that's set in the Forest of Arden. It's directed by Tom Reed, who's also Optimist's associate artistic director, and it stars Kristen Harmergren as the heroine, Rosalind. Tom and Kristen join me in the studio now. Welcome both of you to Lake Effect.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Optimist Theater's fourth, am I right, Tom?
Yes, it's your fourth season.
Fourth season, but brand new things going on, really exciting things because you're in a new home.
Yeah, brand new space. Cadish Park, which is a park that is maintained by the COA, the Children's Outing Association. It's right in the heart of the city. The audience gets a beautiful view of the city. It's one of the best views of the cityscape in the city. It also presents its challenges because there's no wings, there's no backstage, et cetera. So, but it's a pretty thrilling space to be in just when you first arrive there and look out at the city. And we're really excited. I think we're going to be able to draw a really diverse crowd there. And I'm really happy that the COA has given us this opportunity.
And also, didn't BMO Harris sort of step in as a new partner as well?
BMO Harris stepped in big time to help us. We are funded, of course, sort of grassroots. We have a lot of people that give anywhere between, you know, $10 and $1,000. And then we got we received a $20,000 matching grant from BMO Harris, which is allowing us to do this and pay our wonderful performers and tech folk. We don't charge for tickets, so there's no money coming in that way. So we're very grant and donation dependent.
So what are some of the challenges in this new space? I mean, it's obviously got some advantages in that it's got this beautiful view, and from everything I've read, it's got nice acoustics and all of that. But what are some of your technical challenges?
Well, like I said, there's no wing space, there's no backstage space, and the audience is on a hill, and then they're facing the amphitheater, and then directly behind the amphitheater is another steep hill. So the backstage of the amphitheater is a steep hill. So that's a big challenge. The things that have been done there before have all been amplified, and we're going natural voice. So we actually did have to figure out how to make the sound pop a little bit better and what to do with the lights and where to put them. Jason Fassel is our lighting designer. And he brought in lighting trees with weatherproof lights to set those up. And things are looking good, though.
Okay.
Things are looking good. Yeah, it's going to be a production where one of the unique things about it is the audience is going to see a lot of the nuts and bolts, the behind-the-scenes kind of things that happen.
So have you incorporated that into your direction, you know, just making that whole – kind of how the sausage is made part of the production?
Oh, yes, most definitely. There's going to be a little bit of interaction between the actors and the audience. We're trying to make it a more audience-centric production.
In what way?
Involving the audience in the production. There's a point where we're hoping we'll get them cheering at the beginning of the show. There are spots where there's one actor that's going to be sitting in the house and sitting in the audience and delivering lines. And I've also encouraged the actors, if they want to say hello to people after the show, to do so.
In costume and in,
yep.
in character. Yeah. So, well, Kristen, let's bring you in on the conversation because you're playing Rosalind. I should say we haven't even said the name of the play. It's As You Like It.
Yes.
That you're doing this time,
yes.
Which is one of the most wonderful comedies of Shakespeare. And you are playing Rosalind, and it's one of the most delicious parts, I think, ever.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of the tops when you're looking at female roles, not only, you know, to me, not only in Shakespeare, but just in any – all of the dramatic canon. So – it's incredible. We have been at it, you know, together in rehearsal for the last 3 or 4 weeks, and I've been working on it for a while before that. But every day there's something new. It's just a very complex, interesting role. I feel
very lucky.
Is
the first time you've done this, done the role?
It is, yes.
So, okay, so diving into it literally, as you say, she's so complex.
Yeah.
And yet it's also very, very funny.
It is. It's very funny, and it's... she's just so lively, and you have so many opportunities to play and to put on different hats. I mean, I know that I had a time in the rehearsal process where I felt the same thing that Rosalind feels, I think, where when she goes into the forest and she dresses as a man, first to protect herself, but then she sort of really gets into it, that I had this time in rehearsal where I kind of let myself go, like, oh, yeah, now I can – act like a boy and do all those things that go along with it. And, you know, maybe you're just playing and making fun of how you think boys are, or maybe you're doing things that you always wished you could. And, you know, I like to think of myself as not too held back by being a girl in 2013. But you surprise yourself sometimes when you think about those things. So it's really a treat.
So what is it like working outdoors here and with this cast and with Tom?
You know, we were indoors for our rehearsal process. So in the last week, getting outside has been a big change. One of the things actually about the space that I really like is that it's outdoor theater, but it feels very intimate. Just the way that the amphitheater is not as big as I expected, even with like seeing pictures. And I think the audience is actually quite close. You know, if you're in the swinging, we don't know how far back people are going to go. We've had people even in our tech rehearsals just kind of showing up and plopping down and watching from afar. But the sort of main part of the audience is really a part of it. But the biggest challenge mostly was switching, you know, into your outdoor voice. And that just adds a whole new element of what you need to think about, and because, you know, what's the point of all the work if no one can hear you?
But at the same time, you have to keep the intimacy and mm-hmm. and the connection with the other actors that you've developed over the rehearsal, too.
Yeah.
You can't just start shouting at each other.
Right. And that's what it feels like at first. It feels like you're just shouting. And really, in the last couple of days, last night, we had a really nice full run through with costumes and everything. And things started to kind of click back in of communicating with the other people on stage and all that stuff.
Not just projecting.
Not just projecting.
Now, Tom, are you setting As You Like It in Shakespearean times, or are you moving it at a different time?
We've just sort of created our own little world for it. Melissa Benson is our costume designer, and she's created some pretty delightful costumes. But it's its own world. And one thing I want to say is that Rosalind is the largest female role in the Shakespeare canon.
And, you know, I realize that not everybody listening knows the basic story of the play. So we probably should do a very quick synopsis of what it is going into the forest and who Rosalind is and what's happening. So let's do that really fast, and then we can get on to other things.
Sure. Rosalind is the cousin of Celia, and Celia's father is the duke of this city, and he had banished Rosalind's father. And towards the beginning of the play, he gets paranoid, and he banishes Rosalind. But Rosalind and Celia are so close that Celia says, well, I'm going with her. And they also take Touchstone, the court fool, with them. Because they're going out into the forest and it's this unknown place, they come up with these disguises that they think will help protect them and keep them from being preyed upon. Now, before they leave for the forest, Rosalind briefly runs into this young man named Orlando, and they have an instant connection, and they both long for each other and wish to see each other, and they run into each other into the woods, where Rosalind has disguised herself as a man. And she starts teaching Orlando how to be a proper wooer. If he ever runs into Rosalind, how he should properly woo her. But unbeknownst to him, Ganymede, who is teaching him this, is actually Rosalind. And then everything turns out in the end. Shakespeare really set up this sort of dangerous world of the city and this sort of egalitarian, peaceful world of the forest. And I started picturing Shakespeare, because he lived out in the country and worked in the city. And I thought about him leaving his beautiful pastoral home and then arriving at the London Bridge with the heads on the pikes.
And the pestilence and the disease, the everything else that was going on in London.
Right, right.
The filth,
and in the court there, if you think of Henry VIII, you could be his best friend one day and the next day you're losing your head. So.
Right. So there's that sort of treachery and, mm-hmm. and things.
Kind of vigilance about the city. Everyone has to be aware of who's watching you.
Which is interesting, because most of us think of the forest as the scary place, because, you know, you don't go into the forest alone. Don't go there because it's dark and scary, and wild animals might be there. But as you're right, it's presented as a safer and more egalitarian place.
Now, there are characters that are afraid when they get there.
Right.
But they eventually come to peace with their fears and enjoy living in the forest.
Is this the permanent home now?
We hope it will be, yes.
So looking ahead for Optimist Theater, are you looking to do more than one production a year now that you have a more permanent home and things seem to be financially a little more settled?
That's always been a goal. I don't know if it will happen next year. It is a possibility for next year. The more likelihood is probably 2 years down the road. will add a second show. You know, your costs don't quite double, but almost double by adding a second show. So,
what about extending the run of the one that you do now? Is that a possibility as well?
We wanted to see what happened this year as far as crowds and audience and demand. But if the demand is there, we will certainly increase the run. I would really like to be able to increase it to a four weekend run.
I would think just for all the work that,
right,
that everybody's
exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It's all of a sudden it's like, wow, this is going to be over pretty soon.
And so for you, what's next, Kristen, after you finish the show? What's on your calendar?
You know, I am sort of an actor in transition. I finished grad school about a year ago in Madison, and I when I came here, that was my leaving Madison probably for good and moving on. And I'm not really sure where I'm going next. Probably Chicago, but
where the jobs take
yeah,
you.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I'm at that phase where all I really want is to work, and I can go wherever
right.
to do that.
Well, both of you, thanks so much for coming in and break a leg.
Thanks, Bonnie.
Thank you so much.
Tom Reed is the Associate Artistic Director for Optimus Theater and directs their production of As You Like It. He's also on the theater faculty at El Verno College. Kristen Hammergren plays Rosalind. As You Like It previews tonight at 8 at Optimist's new home in Caddish Park and will run the next two weekends. All performances are free. There's more information about the production and about the company at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Coming up next, we'll turn our attention to circuses, circa the early 20th century. Lake Effect returns in just a moment on WUWM. It's Lake Effect on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. Of all the states, perhaps Wisconsin has among the greatest connections to the history of the American circus movement. It was home to the Ringling Brothers, whose circus merged with those of P.T. Barnum and James A. Bailey. And since 1959, it has been home to Circus World, now the Circus World Museum, on the grounds of the former winter home to the Ringling Brothers Circus. A new film by Iowa native Gene Gamache tells the story of the early history of American circuses and of Charles Chappie Fox, the man who single-handedly rescued hundreds of antique circus wagons and restored them at Circus World. The film is called A Circus Life, and Gamache explains how he came to make it.
I was actually making another documentary in Wisconsin, in Appleton, doing a documentary on Houdini, and was introduced, my co-producer and co-director on A Circus Life, Kirk Carter, actually, the two of us were introduced to Chappie Fox by a man named Tom Bolt. Tom actually took us to the circus parade in Milwaukee and kind of got us hooked on this amazing visual event and parade. And we ended up deciding to do the documentary and had some amazing interviews with Chappie Fox. And actually, the first interview was 4 hours long, and he didn't bat an eye. I mean, he was under hot lights. We were actually getting tired and hot, and he just kept going. And it was amazing, the stories he was telling us about the circus and his involvement with collecting these circus wagons.
And the other thing that was so interesting is that this was really a second career for him. It was a passion of his all his life, but being able to do this kind of restoration came to him somewhat late in life.
Yeah, he actually said to us that if he could do it again, he'd live the last 25 years over and over again, because that was his favorite time and the time when he was really involved with the Circus World Museum and collecting these circus wagons and also working tirelessly to have the parade every year.
Now, for you as a filmmaker, how did you first think about putting this on the screen? Because it's a big story. I mean, the first part of the film really kind of talks about the history of the circus in the United States and then kind of goes into the circus wagons. But did you start out thinking that's how you wanted to approach it?
Interestingly, the film was actually originally two parts, and the first part talked about the early American circus and the circus parades and how the wagons were used, and we actually interviewed a couple circus performers, a man by the name of Al Mann and also his wife, Irene, and they told us a little bit what it was like to be on a circus in those days and also a little bit about the circus parades, and then other circus historians talking about the early American circus, and that led up until the demise of the circus parade and kind of the transformation of the circus. And then part two was sort of Chappie getting more involved with the collecting of the wagons and realizing that there was this amazing piece of history out there laying in farm fields, rotting away. And he just felt he needed to rescue those wagons and make them part of the Circus World Museum's collection, because no other museum had that type of collection. It was kind of a two-part documentary that just recently I put the two parts together and created a feature, 88-minute feature-length film.
Yeah, and I think it flows together really nicely because it takes you from that larger overview of what the circus was and why it was so important in American culture, and then taking it down to the more detailed of literally watching artisans recreate and reproduce parts for these wagons because, they, as you say, they had rotted away.
Absolutely. And the thing is, you know, Chappie even says in the film that if they'd started the museum 10 years later, most of these wagons would have been burned up and lost. So the timing was critical. And I think right now they have over 200 wagons in the museum collection in Baraboo. And that collection represents maybe 2/3 of the remaining wagons on the planet that were used by circuses. So, and also the interesting thing to me is these wagons have survived. And, you know, the owners, the circus owners are no longer here who created the wagons, who had them built. The artisans who originally carved and made the wagons are no longer here. But here these wagons have lasted, you know, over 100 years, and they're still with us. It's really amazing. And, you know, they've been on just about every street in America.
This collection here in Wisconsin is about 2/3 of what's extant. And that's only about, what, 3% of what was actually produced and used during the heyday?
Exactly. And it's interesting, but, you know, the circus owners considered these wagons, they were just sort of tools that they used to promote the circus. And once they could no longer use the wagons because the cities changed and they couldn't drive the parade down the middle of Main Street because of cars and streetlights, they ended up becoming junk to the circus owners, and they just trashed them. They threw them off the sides of trains and just discarded them. So that's why they laid in these farm fields for so many years before Chappie and some of these other folks at the Circus World Museum discovered them.
So now, is the restoration still going on? I mean, I know he died about 10 years ago, right?
Yes, that's correct. And they still are restoring wagons. The Circus World Museum is still going strong and actually a wonderful place to visit. You can take the family and see a lot of history there. And you can actually walk through the wagon pavilion right up close to these wagons and see the amazing carvings and the beautiful colors. And it's really educational. They also have performances during the summer months up there in Baraboo at the Circus World Museum grounds.
As you were doing the research for this film and also putting the film together, I mean, did it surprise you that circuses were so important when they were in their heyday?
Actually, yes, it did. And the thing that amazed me the most was, you know, I work in movie advertising. That's what I do for a living, and edit movie trailers. And actually, the circus parade was how the circus actually promoted the circus. It was their trailer. And when they would arrive in town and with all these horses pulling these wagons with, you know, musicians and bands on top of the wagons, they'd create quite a ruckus in town. And that became their arrival and their announcement to the town that the circus is here, follow the parade, and you can see us set up the tent and then later watch the performance. So that was something I really didn't know. You know, I went to the circus when I was a kid, but I didn't realize that's kind of how it got its start. And also, the educational aspect. I had no idea that back then they didn't have the internet. They didn't really have much photography. And so the first chance people ever got to see a lion or an elephant or any of these exotic performers was actually in the circus. And so it wasn't just entertainment. It was also educational.
What about some of the archival footage that you used here? How did you track some of that down? It was amazing to see, particularly when you talked about Alman and his wife, and there was some footage there, not just still photographs, but actual moving footage of him performing.
Yes, well, both of them worked with the Ringling Brothers early in their careers, and they worked with various circuses. And finding the footage, Al was gracious enough to definitely give us some still photographs, but a lot of materials we were able to get from Circus World Museum. That really helped us to really tell the story of the history of it, because it was a long time ago, and when you get to see that archival footage and then you connect that with the current day footage of the parade moving down the streets of Milwaukee, it really tells you what a great piece of history this is and why it's so important to save it.
The footage that you speak of going down Wisconsin Avenue, which pretty much ends the film, it's funny because those of us who've moved here later know that view with the Calatrava Art Museum, and it's not there in that footage, which is funny. So it means it's earlier than when the Calatrava was built.
Absolutely, that's true. And I remember the first time I saw the parade, I was just stunned, and I thought, how did I not know about this? And I think mostly people only in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, or in the surrounding area knew about the parade and even knew it existed. So it's something that I hope people will, you know, get out and see the film and have an appreciation for, you know, how hard Chappie Fox worked to bring these wagons back to life and have them paraded down the streets of Milwaukee.
Does that still happen?
Actually, no. The last parade they did was 2009. And even then, they weren't doing it every year. They were only doing it every few years. And it was very expensive. It cost about $2 million to have the parade. And also, there was never a corporate sponsor, per se, where they would brand, you know, this is the, you know, Schlitz Brewing Company parade or anything like that. It was always private donors. And companies would donate the money to have the parade, but they didn't have their names, you know, put on the wagons or anything like that. So that made it a special event as well, because it really was an authentic circus parade.
One of my favorite shots in the latter part of the film is when they're getting the modern day roustabouts are getting the wagons onto the train in Baraboo to get it here.
Exactly. And in the film, one of the gentlemen talks about that. Some of these guys who show up every year in that summer, and they just want to be a part of the circus, and they actually kind of play circus. They'll take their vacation and time it just so they can be there for the loading of the wagon and also the train ride and also the unloading of the wagon.
I can understand the appeal. It goes back to what everyone kept saying in the film. A lot of different people said it in different ways about the romance of the circus.
Exactly. And I think, you know, especially with the 750 horses that pull the wagons, it's very much a romantic vision. And you see the horses moving in slow motion in the film, and you feel the grandness. And also, you know, it's something that happened hundreds of years ago when the circus would come to town. There weren't motorized vehicles to pull the wagons back then. So seeing the horses and the beautiful carved wagons, it really kind of takes you back to a time when things were simpler and there was no internet, there were no cell phones. And I think it's something that we can all appreciate and take a step back and really look at where we're at today and where we used to be. I think that's something that the film offers, is a chance to step back and, you know, sort of it's a little bit of a time capsule.
What about looking forward? I know circuses, there are still some around and people still go. Do they still hold on the imagination? Do people still find them romantic?
Absolutely. I haven't really been to the circus in recent years. So I'm guessing I think the circuses are still going strong. And I think they've just, one of the strengths of the circuses is that they've been able to change and adapt. And, you know, they still have the trapeze acts and some of the animal acts, but I think they've also, you know, sort of transformed themselves to be able to compete with all the different forms of entertainment that are out there. I mean, now you have, you know, movies and video games and the internet and music. It's just, there's a lot out there for the circuses to compete with. I think they've done a pretty good job. And in some ways, you know, they're still maybe a little bit like these wagons when they used to parade them, they're almost alien, because back in the day, people saw them for the first time and they were alien. And now when you see them today, they're also sort of alien because they're from another time period and another place that most of us aren't familiar with. Maybe our grandparents are, but we aren't. So it's actually a nice way to look at them as sort of a new thing when they come down the street.
Doing this film, has it made you want to go to the circus more?
Absolutely. I mean, the circus, you know, the next time the circus comes to town, maybe I'll get a chance to see it. It's just I haven't had a chance to in recent years. And actually, I now have a 11-month-old son. So I'm sure I'll be going to the circus in the next few years when he's a little bit older.
Perfect opportunity.
Yes.
You'll get out there. You won't be just making a film about the old ones. You'll actually go see the new ones.
Exactly.
Well, Gene, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you bringing me on the show.
Jean Gamache is the producer and director of the film A Circus Life, which showed last month at the Oriental Theater. We spoke with him then. There's a link to more information about the film and about the Circus World Museum in Baraboo at wuwm.com/lake effect. Milwaukee writer Dean Jensen has had circus history on his mind for a long time. His new book tells the tragic story of two of the circus's early superstars. We'll hear about it next when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Before the break, we heard from Jean Gamache, producer of a film about the heyday of the American circus and the wagon parades that were part and parcel of the phenomenon. Like any popular form of entertainment, the circus also had its superstars. And in the early 20th century, no stars were brighter than Lillian Leitzel and Alfredo Codona, who both performed dazzling stunts high in the air, Leitzel from the rings and Codona from the trapeze. Leitzel and Codona's lives intersected early and then diverged, but came back together at the apex of their careers and resulted in their marriage. But it was not a happily ever after story. Their story of love and tragedy is the subject of Milwaukee writer Dean Jensen's new book, Queen of the Air. Jensen told Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke that at the time, the circus held a high place in the public consciousness.
It was the biggest entertainment and the most democratic entertainment in the early 20s, actually for the first several decades of the 20th century. And it was an entertainment also that crosshatched the entire country. There were, at that period in history, more than 100 circuses. Now, some of them were just tiny affairs of a few horse-drawn wagons. And then there were circuses of great size that traveled in trains with more than 100 cars, half the animals that might be found at the Bronx Zoo. It was an opportunity for people back then to a rural audience to see things that otherwise hadn't been available to them.
And you say democratic. I mean, the idea is that people from all stratas of society were captivated by it.
Exactly, yeah. There was not another day more exciting in most communities than Circus Day, the day that the circus appeared. Businesses would shut down. Schools would recess if they were in session. It was just a magical day. It was a day as important as Christmas in most communities. There would be excitement in a community for weeks before because the bill posters would come to town and broom up all of these garish posters advertising the attractions of the circus. And it was really magical.
Well, and the stars of the circus, what would their equivalent be today?
Their equivalent would be the huge rock stars of the day, you know, the Beyoncés and the Madonnas. I don't know if Madonna is any longer a huge rock star, but Leitzel herself, the heroine of my book, was really a diva. Her name was known everywhere. Her full name was Lillian Leitzel, but everybody just referred to her as Leitzel.
Much like Madonna or Beyonce.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Would you say, did her public appeal lie more in her glamour or her athleticism, or can you separate the two?
I don't think you can separate the two. She was almost fairy-like in the first place. She was just 4'9", weighed 94 pounds. So she was this tiny little woman, but she did amazing things in the big top stratosphere. Her signature performance was when she would do flanges, or these are throwovers in which she'd be dangling from the Roman ring in the sky of the big top, do these throwovers of her body, heels overhead, in which she actually dislocated her arm from her shoulder with each of these revolutions. And it was grueling. It was almost painful to watch.
And she would do dozens of these.
She would do sometimes as many typically would do 100 in a performance. It would be 90 or 110. And while she was doing these, the crowd would be tolling off the numbers, 20, 21, 22. And at the same time, the drummers in the band would be tolling off her throwovers. They would become so fast, they would start out slow, and then they would keep, as her momentum gathered, they would get faster and faster. And she would be suddenly just kind of a blur in the near the ceiling of the big top.
By the end of her time in the circus, she had been doing this for years.
She had started really when she was 8 years old, and she was 39 when she fell to her death. She fell to her death on a Friday the 13th in February. In fiction, one would never be as preposterous to suggest that this happened on a Friday the 13th, but in fact, is when she fell to her death. And she fell not because of she slipped off the Roman rings, but rather the Roman rings, which were attached to a hanging rope by a metal fixture, that fixture crystallized, and then she plunged to her death.
Not only was it Friday the 13th, if I'm not mistaken, she was also 13th on the billing
on
that
the program. Yeah, this book is also, in writing it almost seemed as though there were gods involved, and the circus people are very suspicious. So they think their world is determined really by happiness of the of the gods and fates.
Well, and the other character, you know, if she was the queen of the circus, the character that is also at the heart of this book never seems like he quite became the king, but he was certainly royalty. Tell us about where Alfredo Cadona started. He had pretty humble origins, if you will.
He did indeed. His father had a family circus in Mexico that never had great, great success. It traveled in a single railroad car, a baggage car. He would rent space in it and then move through Mexico, primarily played little desert towns. And the circus at first was largely made up of just his father, Eduardo, and his mother, Hortense. And then some children came along, among them Alfredo, and they became part of the circus. But yes, His origins were humble ones, and in fact, it was his sister Victoria, who was a slackwire walker, who first gained wider attention. She was hired by the Barnum & Bailey Circus in America, and Alfredo, this young trapeze flyer, her brother, just was kind of thrown in on the deal. But he became the greatest flyer of all time. He was known for what is called in the circus the triple. This is a feat that has probably taken more circus daredevils than any other. And what one did in the triple is you would leave the swinging bar of the trapeze and then throw three somersaults in the air while traveling at 60 miles an hour and then dock up with the catcher at the other end of the trapeze rigging. It took him 10 years to perfect that feat, but then he became known as sort of the Nijinsky of the flying trapeze. He was just a graceful flyer.
Well, and if it weren't tragedy enough that Lietzel fell to her death from the trapeze, there was plenty of tragedy in the love affair between Lietzel and Alfredo. They both had marriages that came and went leading up to their marriage to each other. In fact, Alfredo's marriage ended because he reconnected with Lietzel, who he had always been in love with.
Yes.
It was not, I guess, from your description, given their history and past relationships, Lietzel and Alfredo seemed like they were the wrong people to be married to each other. What were their expectations for this marriage?
Their marriage at times was just passionate. They were absolutely mad for one another, but at other times it became very tempestuous. Even though Lietzel, with some misgivings, had married Alfredo, and this was partly brought on by the management, she would continue to see other men. And, of course, Alfredo was, you know, jealous at these dalliances she had with other men. So that was a source of a lot of difficulty in that marriage. But as I said, it was, to some degree, was brought on by the management, because Lizzo was such an adored figure that the circus would arrange assignations between Lizzo and judges and mayors and others in the other world that the circus thought might be helpful to the circus. This, as I said, was a source of just constant irritation in that marriage, as it would be in any marriage, I should guess.
Well, and of course, at the same time, Lietzel had insisted that that Alfredo get rid of his ex-wife as part of the act and replace her with someone else. The someone else ended up being involved with Alfredo, and they ended up marrying after Lietzel's death.
Yeah, yeah. Lietzel was troubled by the fact that even though Alfredo and his first wife, Clara Curtin, a flyer in his act, had divorced, he had retained her in his flying act. There were three in the act. There was Alfredo and Clara Curtin, and then Lalo Cadona, who was the catcher in the act. So Lizzo was bothered by the fact that Alfredo continued Clara's employment in the act, and she finally persuaded him to shelve that earlier wife. And then at Lizzo's suggestion, Alfredo hired another young woman on the circus, Vera Bruce, who in fact had been an apprentice of Lizzo, a very attractive woman. That was probably not a good case of judgment on Lizzo's part, because then Alfredo became attracted to Vera in a romantic way, and thus the Alfredo and Lizzo marriage started fraying.
And inevitably, after Lizzo's death, the Alfredo and Vera marriage frayed as well, and ended in the ultimate tragedy of this book.
The ultimate tragedy in the book. They both came to very violent ends. They divorced, or were very nearly divorced. Alfredo then took Vera's life and then his own. You know, look at the arc of this book. It's almost like a modern Greek tragedy, I think, because in tragedy, by definition, at least in a literary definition, the players put their own ends into motion. And I think this happened in this instance as well, because of the foibles of the characters in the book. They all put their own ends, which were violent, into motion.
Dean Jensen, thank you so much for sharing it with us.
I much enjoyed it. Thank you.
Dean Jensen is the author of the new book, Queen of the Air, A True Story of Love and Tragedy at the Circus, published by Crown. Jensen is the former arts critic for the Milwaukee Sentinel and owns the Dean Jensen Gallery. He spoke with Mitch Tyke last month, and our interview with him first aired then as well. And that's all the time we have today. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for joining us. I hope you can be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect. It's all on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.